I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, economics is a topic that intimidates many as seemingly impenetrable. Concepts like neoliberalism, modern monetary theory, and universal basic income are often talked about in public discourse. But what are they? Doug Henwood, founder of the Left Business Observer and host of the Behind the News radio program, joins us to demystify economics, as well as to discuss current events, specifically the Democratic presidential debates, and talk of an increased wealth tax drawing the ire and rage of billionaires. As previously mentioned, Doug Henwood is the founder of the Left Business Observer, a newsletter launched in 1986 to examine and analyze economic affairs from a left-wing perspective. Although Doug has since retired The Observer, over the course of its run, the newsletter garnered praise from such influential figures as Joseph Stiglitz and Noam Chomsky. Former Wall Street Journal executive editor Norman Perlstein once said of Doug and the Left Business Observer, "You're scum, sick and twisted. It's tragic you exist." Now, I think for many of my listeners, that'll actually serve as a ringing endorsement. Additionally, Doug also wrote the book Wall Street, How It Works and For Whom, which was published by Verso in 1997. The book has since went out of print, and the rights have reverted to Doug. As a result, he's chosen to make the book freely available as a PDF through the Creative Commons license. You can download that book through the Left Business Observer or WallStreetTheBook.com, absolutely free of charge. And finally, Doug is also the host of the excellent Behind the News radio program, which has featured such guests as Christopher Hitchens, Gore Vidal, George McGovern, Slavoj Žižek, as well as many others, and is currently working on a new book concerning the rot of America's ruling class. Plainly put, Doug Henwood is a distinguished commentator and analyst, more than equipped to help us demystify the world of economics. With that being said, why don't we jump right into the conversation? Welcome to Parallax Views, Doug Henwood of the Behind the News radio program.
Yes, good to be here. Thanks for having me. It's funny, I still call it a radio program in this era of podcasting, but I guess I'm still stuck in the terrestrial model to some degree.
So, Doug, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about not only Behind the News, but also how you sort of got involved in politics and, you know, economics, because you sort of, to my knowledge, started out as a more of a young conservative at one point.
Well, I did have this conservative period beginning my freshman year in college. It didn't last very long. It was a kind of post-adolescent rebellion that I shook off after about, I don't know, must have been somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, all in all. I was, in those days of my right-wing moment, thinking of becoming an economics major in college. And I was always undecided between that and English, because I was really very much into poetry in particular, and critical theory and that sort of thing. So when I gave up the right-wing politics, I also gave up the economics for a while, became an English major, did 3 years of graduate English, was going to write a dissertation on a psychoanalysis of American poetry from Emerson through Whitman through Stevens that was going to look at the narcissistic character in all these poets, but also try to relate them to changes in the political economy from small-scale competitive capitalism to large-scale finance bureaucratic capitalism. And I started dipping back into the economics literature, which I hadn't looked at in some time, and decided I really kind of liked it, and read more and more of it. And then one day in 1986, I said, oh, I know, I'll start a newsletter, because desktop publishing had just come upon the world. And I had this idea that a lot of left writing on economics was either dull or arcane or really not up to the new up to date on the headlines. So I thought I was going to bridge a gap between that kind of more formal understanding, theoretical historical understanding of the economy from the left, but also keep up with the business press and the news in the financial markets and all that sort of thing. So I started it in September 86. And as I was writing it, I realized that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. And then a few years later, Verso asked me to do a book. And I signed a contract to do Wall Street in 1989. And it took me almost 6 years, actually, to write the book, because I had that same situation. I can write this in 6 months. And then I realized how little I knew. And so I spent years reading a lot of Marxian, Keynesian economics, stuff about the financial markets, interviewing people, doing a mix of sort of semi-scholarly and journalistic work. And that came out in 95, or 96 rather, and paperback in 97. But it was really almost like a self-induced graduate education. I didn't, when I went into that not really knowing all that much, and ended up knowing a fair amount about finance and ended up a lot more confident about what I was saying. So, you know, it took me about the better part of a decade to really figure out what I was doing.
It's interesting that you sort of came to economics almost in a, I don't want to say self-educated, but you didn't go into it with that as your major or anything. You were majoring in English initially. Do you think that gave you an advantage in some ways at looking at economic issues?
Yeah, I think so, in a couple of ways. One, I think the literary background helped me be a better writer. Most economists, with a few exceptions, like Galbraith and Keynes and Marx in moments, are pretty terrible writers. And are most social scientists, sad to say. Even as valuable as I find the work, it's sometimes hard to hack through it. But also, I did take some economics courses in college. It was the heyday of Yale Keynesianism, so I got to take introductory macroeconomics from James Tobin, subsequent Nobel Prize winner. I got intermediate macro from William Nordhaus, who has become more recently famous as an environmental economist. So I got a good dose of sort of mainstream Keynesian liberal economics, but I didn't get deeply into the formal nature of the field. And you know, once you get past the introductory level, economics gets really, really mathematical. It's coming back from that a little bit. They're doing more empirical work now than they did 10 or 20 years ago, but it's still very much a mathematical profession. And I think that really damages one's understanding of what it's all about. You get so enamored of your models that you really stop paying much attention to empirical reality. So I think by not having gotten immersed in that that kind of formal economics, it did give me a broader perspective and a way of understanding how to talk to a broader public and not get lost in technicalities. Now, there are certainly a lot of people who did go through the full rigor of economics training and emerge with their humanity undamaged. But it's the odds are against you. I mean, it's a very it's a very distorting view of the world. It's just all turns. Assumes everyone is or tries to turn them into just these, you know, rational calculators, self-maximizing.
Homo economicus, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're what Keynes called the Benthamite contraption. We're all supposed to rank order our preferences and act accordingly, and it's just a debased and cramped view of the world, and I'm glad I didn't get too wrapped up in that. You know, there's a lot to be... There's a lot in the field that's useful, for sure. But I think I'm glad I didn't get into the PhD level of training.
Not to put you on the spot here, but I'm curious: are there any examples that come to mind with regards to you mentioned that sometimes people get too caught up in the models and the mathematics and miss the empirical evidence. Are there any examples that come to mind that could further elucidate that for my audience?
Well, when I wrote the Wall Street book, I read a lot of the finance literature, and that is just pure math, almost all of it. So there's little interest in economics of how finance and the real world are connected to each other. So, for example, you have people who do macroeconomics sort of forget about the financial sector. And then people who do financial economics forget about what they call the real sector. It's pretty funny that they call it the real sector because it implies that they're operating in the unreal sector. But I think that that kind of financial economics is an example of that kind of over-mathematized view of the world that just gets lost with any sense of physical or social reality. But I was just looking at a paper, an abstract of a paper, a new National Bureau of Economics National Bureau of Economic Research working paper. And NBER working papers are often quite interesting. They publish a lot of good stuff in that series. But this one was trying to explain the rise of income inequality by building a model showing that the higher paid people expend more effort. That's why income has polarized so badly over the last couple of decades. I really don't think, no matter what your mathematical model tells you, that effort explains that.
Well, it's interesting, too. I think more people are getting interested in economics. There's a lot of talk about modern monetary theory. And also, before we get into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about a term that gets thrown around a lot, neoliberalism. It's thrown around a lot, but I'm not sure anyone really defines it. And then, you know, a lot of people will say, "Oh, I've never spotted a neoliberal in the wild." I forget if it was someone like David Frum or David Brooks that said that some time ago. And I was curious if you could maybe illuminate, what sort of neoliberalism is and what it means for people that may be unfamiliar with it as a concept.
Well, it is true that people shy away from the label. It's almost like calling somebody a pedophile. It seems like it's a very bad thing to be called. And some people, you know, like the Stephen Tellis, who's a political scientist at Johns Hopkins, who's a pure neoliberal, gets really annoyed if you call him that. But, you know, he is one. And I think the word is thrown around recklessly. It's overused. It's used sometimes as an epithet. It's just something I don't like is neoliberal. But there are some writers who've done a pretty good job, or a very good job, of elucidating just what it means. It starts with a series of lectures that Foucault gave towards the end of his life in the late 70s, in which he looked at a lot of mostly American, but also some German economists like Gary Becker. Then Philip Murawski did a good book on it. Quinn Slobodian more recently did a really fine book on the historical intellectual history of neoliberalism from the founding of the Mont Pelerin Society back in the late 1940s to the present. And there's a new collection just out from Fordham University Press called Mutant Neoliberalism that looks at what's happened to the doctrine in the wake of the financial crisis. But I would list a couple of features that are really important about it. One is that it's the view of humanity, that what you mentioned, that Homo economicus view, that we're all just rational calculators. But what it takes it a step further in that it sees us not as workers or bosses or any kind of, you know, collective or a political category, but instead we're all just like little modules of human capital. We're not workers. We're just embodiments of human capital. And that's, we just see the world as a way to, we just look to maximize our returns by in our interactions with the economic world. So there's that view of us all as these isolated monads running around like a little small business all to ourselves.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I've often heard it described as a sort of viewing everyone as having to be their own manager.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you're a portfolio of skills and things like that. And this has resulted in, and this worldview has been promulgated very intensely, propagandized at us really since the early 1980s. And it's resulted in, and there always were these tendencies within capitalism, especially American capitalism, but it's resulted in this sense that if you're unemployed, it's your fault. You know, everything is, there's only self-reliance. It's very anti-political. We can't have any kind, we can improve our lot through collective political action. It's all just, you know, writing a better resume or getting an additional degree or whatever. So there's that kind of very individualized approach to the world. And there was an interesting book that came out a few years ago by a sociologist, Jennifer Silva, in which she talked to a bunch of working class young adults who'd completely embodied this worldview. It was all self-reliance. It was if you're in trouble, it was because of your own failures. It was amazing to see young working class people really have incorporate this worldview, which originates in the high end of bourgeois society, but then ends up getting incorporated into the inner life of working class people. But there's another angle to it, which is very important, and this is something that Slobodian emphasizes in his work. This idea among some sort of naive pro-capitalists that capitalism is sort of spontaneous. It's the state of nature. If you just left, removed what they call distortions, then this is kind of what everything would just sort of tend towards a natural capitalist order. That's not true. And the thing that the people around Hayek and Milton Friedman, the Mont Pelerin Society, its first generation of neoliberals. And I got to say, they're really very substantial people. It's easy to mock them, and they did many evil things. But they're really substantial, thoughtful people who had a vision of where they wanted the world to go and how to get there. They, I have to say, they've been very successful at it. But they see democracy as a threat, and that because left to their own devices, people want things be done for them. They don't want to be all these self-reliant people. They don't want to fight with stress and poverty and alienation. They would like a nicer world, basically. And anytime you give people too much democratic control over their economic fate, they're going to move in that direction. We can't have that. That would violate what they call economic freedom. So they see the state as very, very important. But the role of the state is not to soften the harsh effects of the market or to lead to some sort of socialization of the productive sector. No, it's the role of the state and politics is to keep politics out of the economy. It's to create this framework, a legal framework where you can have contracts and have sound money and all this sort of thing, but with no interference raise wages or regulate the environment or any of this sort of thing that people might think of as the decent side of what a state can do in an economy. So they're very, very aware of the role of politics in limiting the role of politics in the economy. One of their passions since the Mont Pelerin Society was founded in, I believe, 1947, has been to roll back the welfare state. They thought we were inexorably heading towards a socialist future, and we had to put a brake on that, and they had to undo the welfare state. And, you know, we've certainly seen that happen. Thatcher and Reagan, but also Pinochet, around the world, whatever advances the welfare state made during the period of the Depression and the early post-World War II years, most of those have been rolled back, even, you know, in this, the home of social democracy like Sweden. Certainly Sweden would have a long way to go till its welfare state looked like the American one, but they've peeled that one back too. So that's a lot of what neoliberalism is: the use of the state and politics to limit the role of politics in making the economy a less harsh master.
I want to get into sort of the prior models that were being worked with before neoliberalism, but I wanted to mention something and get your thoughts on it. There a while back there was some articles coming out on the Koch brothers, the infamous Koch brothers. I believe it was Charles Koch said that it would be good if more students read Marx. And I remember a few of my leftist friends were saying, well, why would he want to do that? Why this is very bizarre. And I said, these people aren't really against reading Marx or anything. They just want Marx to be interpreted in the way that they frame him. Hayek sort of had a specific way of framing Marx's writings. And I think that's what the sort of goal is with the Koch brothers saying that.
I guess they understand the class struggle, but from above. So the ways that Marx and Marxists can eliminate the class conflict, I guess they can see it as a field manual for their side. But I have to say, like Hayek and Friedman, Charles Koch in particular, David, who died recently, was the playboy of the pair, but Charles was a serious thinker. And he too had this very rigorous vision of the world that he wanted to see made real. I talked to somebody who met him back in the mid-70s who said, this is the work of 40 years, and here we are a little over 40 years later, and he's certainly accomplished a lot. And he had a very detailed plan for how to remake the world, and with his money and with his colleagues in the Koch network, they've had a very successful run of it. But they didn't do it by being ignoramuses. They did it in a very informed way. And they take academics and academic knowledge very, very seriously. And it shows. I mean, they've been endowing institutes and chairs and think tanks all over the place because they think that the production – they have this very hierarchical view of the dissemination of ideas. So you finance the elites who come up with the ideas, then the think tanks who spread them around to the journalistic world, get on TV, and then you have the mass of politicians and your rank and file people who are the people who make, who realize the visions that are concocted by the folks way up on high. But it is it's a very detailed view of how the world works, and they've been very impressive with it. I wish we had something like that on my side.
Well, it's very interesting to me that, even with the rise of neoliberalism in the 80s, I think we still have the remnants of things like FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. It's interesting that despite the sort of attempts to stamp out the welfare state as much as possible, even neoliberalism sort of has to work within it. It can't completely demolish that, it seems like.
Well, as long as there's any vestige of democracy, no, they can't, because it's just simply too unpopular, which is why they look to somebody like Pinochet. Or Milton Friedman's grandson, Patry, had an essay in a Cato Institute journal a few years ago, in which he said he was just done with politics because he understood that the masses were just not very fond of his libertarian dream, and that he just said we needed to secede from the society. So they, come up with these ideas like seasteading, of developing offshore colonies where they could live in their libertarian paradise. But they believe they're anti-democratic. They think that democracy interferes with what they see as economic freedom, and what they mean by economic freedom is the ability of bosses and capital to do whatever it wants to.
And if you could comment on, do you still see the sort of remnants of FDR's New Deal in our society today? Do you think that's really going away anytime soon?
Well, you know, they keep trying to get rid of Social Security or privatize Social Security. Again, Pinochet was able to do that because he, you know, killed people. But as long as we have a democratic government, it's going to be very, very hard to do that. They're doing their best to foment generational war, I guess, so that somehow young people will feel that Social Security is robbing their future. And when you're young, it's kind of hard to imagine you might be old someday and need Social Security yourself. But even that, I've been working at that for a few decades. Pete Peterson made that his the work of his last 20 years on Earth by funding think tanks and books and all kinds of things like that to promote this generational war and privatizing Social Security. That's not going anywhere. And Medicare, which is a product of the Johnson era, that's not going anywhere. In fact, we have more people talking about universalizing Medicare than we have now talking about shrinking it. So it's once these things are established, they're very, very hard to get rid of. And the right understands this, which is why they don't want to establish new entitlements, as they say. Some friends of mine, Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin, wrote a book on the establishment of the U.S. dominated global system at the end of World War II, and they interviewed the chairman at the time of GM, and Sam and Leo are Canadian, and so they asked the chair of GM, I don't understand why you don't want national health insurance. In Canada, GM saves money because, they have the health costs per vehicle in the U.S. are so much higher than they are in Canada. Why don't you want to have a similar system here? And this chair of GM said, we don't want to create a new entitlement. We don't want to increase people's expectations. They want to beat people's expectations down. And that has been one of the triumphs of this neoliberal era, is like the beating down of expectations. We do see some signs that is being reversed with the rise of, Sanders and AOC and this new generation of younger socialists. But it's been 40 years of beating down people's expectations.
Isn't there I know you mentioned it in another interview. I think you have some friends that actually are involved with a sort of research institute or center that tracks some of the infrastructure stuff from the New Deal and its impacts today.
Oh, yeah. The Living New Deal people. Yeah, that comes out of Berkeley. Greg Brechin and Dick Walker, particularly, two retired geographers from Berkeley who've been cataloging all the New Deal projects, which had never been done before. Whether they're post offices or bridges or roads or waterworks, all kinds of things all over the country. We're still living on that because we just don't do infrastructure anymore.
And getting into modern monetary theory, I see a lot of people sort of talk about it, now as sort of related to Keynes and related to the FDR era. Is that exactly the case, or what is really going on there? And maybe we could talk a little bit about Keynes and his legacy.
Well, that's a big topic. I would say a couple of things. Modern monetary theory, which is pretty hard to define, it's a very slippery target. And every time you start criticizing them, they say, well, that's not what we mean. What we mean is, and then if you say, then they'll say, well, you didn't really read our stuff. You didn't read. And if you say, well, I really did read that, I just don't agree with you, they say, well, maybe you're too stupid to understand it. So it's really hard to debate with these folks. And they get very nasty very quickly on the social media. Although, I certainly return some of it. I won't deny that. The basic idea is that money is a creation of the state. The state creates money and, as they put it, spends it into the economy. There are a couple of things wrong with that, because the state doesn't create the money out of nowhere. If you actually look at the operations of the U.S. government, it either borrows money or spends taxes. It just doesn't create money out of thin air. That's just not the way it works. I mean, they have this every day the Treasury publishes a statement of its operations, and you can look at it. It looks very much like a conventional account, only with a lot more zeros. That they get so much in tax revenues, they get so much in proceeds of borrowing, and then they spend so much. And at the end of the day, they have a balance in their checking account at the Federal Reserve, just like anyone else. So that's just not a fact, that the money is created out of nothing and spent into the economy, as they like to say. One of the problems I have with it, and I have many, is that they really don't seem to be very interested in what happens in the private economy. That money is a convenience for exchange. When we buy and sell commodities or our labor power or whatever, where, it's that kind of exchange that gives money its value. The reason money is valuable, and the MMT people will say, is because it's the unit you pay taxes in, which is true, but that's not all you do. A dollar in my pocket is worth something because I can go out and buy something with it. The government doesn't have anything to do with that, really. It's the government maybe will provide a stable economic environment so the money retains its value, but the government doesn't create the value of that gets realized in exchange. But if you look back, they often talk about the New Deal, and you look back at that period. Well, the government borrowed money to fund the WPA and all those other New Deal projects. It raised taxes on particularly on rich folks. So it was pretty conventional in that sense, taxing and borrowing. There was no money creation out of nowhere, as they sometimes seem to claim. And if you look back at the New Deal, actually, the deficits were quite small. Actually, in most years, smaller than what we're going through now. We have a deficit now of 4 to 5% of GDP, and it was 3 to 4% for much of the New Deal, or even less. We really went crazy during World War II when we hit deficits of like 20% of GDP, but that was the extreme of war, and it certainly got the economy back on foot. But that was also done with borrowing. It wasn't like they didn't run the printing press. This is what Keynes's original idea was, that you can use government spending to jumpstart an economy that had gotten stuck at a really low level of employment and activity. There's nothing, but there was no monetary magic about it. It was not at all printing money, the humming of the printing press, none of that stuff. There's a lot to be said for Keynes. His analysis of finance is really profound. But to say that he is somehow the father of this modern monetary theory, snake oil, is really an insult to his memory.
I wanted to comment with regards to Keynes too. I think sometimes he gets painted as a man of the sort of left, but I don't think he was necessarily. I wouldn't describe him as anti-capitalist. He was sort of he was an aristocrat trying to sort of save the system from itself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's very clear on that. His vision of the world was to have people like him planning things. He had several vague comments about what he says in the general theory, the somewhat comprehensive socialization of investment. Never makes it clear what he means by that, but it seems that he wanted some kind of national investment board that would guide private investment in ways that people like him thought were worthy. I suppose that would be better than just leaving it up to the chaos of the capitalist market. But, it's not at all revolutionary. And he was very clear that he was trying to save capitalism from itself. And Roosevelt did, too. Roosevelt was very clear on that. A lot of the securities regulation, for example, that was introduced during the 1930s was very explicitly designed to remove the issue of the ownership of property from politics. And Roosevelt was very clear about that. The people around him were very clear about that, that if you could cripple finance to a degree that, once we got out of the recession, if we could didn't want to go back to the era of the 1920s when finance could do whatever it wanted to, and that created a big mess, but also created a big political backlash against capitalism, finance capitalism in particular. And the people around Roosevelt were very clear that they didn't want that to happen again. And by hindering finance, limiting its power, they would save the larger system from itself.
And is there a similarity there with MMT? I mean, as far as I understand it, MMT's proponents wouldn't necessarily call themselves anti-capitalist. In fact, I've seen some say that that MMT is compatible with everything from social democracy to Austrian libertarian economics.
Yeah, Randy Ray, who is one of the founding gurus of MMT, has said exactly that it's consistent with any kind of politics. I'm not sure it's really true, but it's what he says, that it's consistent with any kind of politics. And Stephanie Kelton, who is probably the most famous of the MMTers, certainly the most visible in the media and on the social media, has said Marx is important once. So they're really not interested in issues of class. In fact, I think quite the opposite, that class disappears in their analysis. They're not but all these, like I say, it's really hard to figure out exactly what they recommend because they're so slippery in these recommendations. But it does seem that they're just not interested in looking at class conflict or class interest or anything like that. And you know, one of the features of MMT is a job guarantee, which doesn't necessarily proceed from the heart of the theory, but everyone who is part of that school pretty much endorses it. And I don't think they really take enough they don't appreciate enough what a job guarantee would do to class relations. I think a job guarantee is a fine idea, although certainly some of my anti-work friends don't like the idea at all. But, you know, if you have a guaranteed job and unemployment is eliminated as a serious threat to people's lives, that would really change class dynamics in ways that, you know, if the job paid anything like a decent amount of money, it would really erode work discipline, which would be a good thing from my point of view. But it would make it much harder for the boss to be boss. If you knew, you know, if you told the boss to go to hell and you could go out the door and get a guaranteed job, that would really change the nature of work, perhaps in good ways. But they don't even really seem to give that much thought. There's just a big absence of thinking about class in MMT world.
Well, yeah, it seems like if you put in policies that are going to challenge the ruling class, the ruling class will fight back, and maybe that hasn't been thought through.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they think that the ruling class wouldn't notice or what, but they would not like a job guarantee unless it was like, you know, some crappy picking up litter for $5 an hour kind of thing. That, you know, but if we're, you know, they're talking about a $15 minimum wage, that's, I don't know, somewhere about the middle of the third of the way up the income distribution, a $15 wage. That's seriously decent money by the standards of American low wage economy, and it would really reconfigure class relations, like I say, in perhaps a very good way. But they don't really seem to think through the implications of it.
Now, I don't know if this is necessarily tied in with MMT, but the other proposal I see becoming popular, especially amongst a lot of younger people, even on the left, which surprises me, is UBI, or Universal Basic Income. And I've been very, very wary of that. To me, it just seems like something promoted by the likes of Milton Friedman, although I believe later on he changed his tune on that. And even Charles Murray of Bell Curve fame seems to be a fan of it. And it just seems to be a way of, decimating the last vestiges of the welfare state.
Yeah, well, a lot depends upon the details of it. But a lot of Silicon Valley types like it, too. I believe Elon Musk is a UBI guy. And, you know, a lot of these Silicon Valley guys who think that automation is going to render all our jobs obsolete, which I just don't think is happening. But that's what they think. But a lot depends upon the nature of the UBI. Like, how high do you set it? Do you have a really chintzy UBI, $5,000 a year? Or do you have one that some people can live on, like, you know, $25,000, $30,000 a year or something like that? If it's the latter, it would be incredibly expensive. It would take up like the entire GDP to do something like that. Not quite, but, you know, close to it. And if it's small, then what is it? And so, the OECD has done the official think tank for a lot of the rich countries, has done a lot of work on this. And they found that the only way you could begin to afford one is by ending all other social welfare programs and just, you know, folding them all into this UBI scheme. It also has, dare I say, a very neoliberal understanding of at its base, in which we shouldn't provide social services, but just people give people money so they can make their own decisions on what to spend money on. And there's a kind of John Clark, who is an anti-poverty activist in Toronto, emphasizes this point, that it's just it's a very consumerist view of the world. There's no notion of solidarity, of you know, caring for each other, which is something that capitalism destroys and I think badly needs to be recreated. It's just, you know, give people money and they can spend it according to their own lights rather than like providing health care, providing education, providing income support if you run into trouble, you know, all the functions of a traditional welfare state. But like I said, if it were truly universal, it would have to be very, 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 very basic income.
Well, if not MMT or UBI, where do you think, and I know this is speculative and maybe a very big question, but where do you think the left can look to in terms of organizing and sort of pushing back against neoliberalism?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the old traditional welfare state stuff is good. We see Sanders making a big deal out of Medicare for All. That is not universally popular, but it's quite popular with a lot of people. You know, you look at the Scandinavian welfare states, and they've been pared back considerably over the last couple of decades. But still, they spend an awful lot of money on social protection, on education, on you know, we actually spend a phenomenal amount of money on healthcare and don't cover anybody, everybody, because our system is so inefficient. So we don't really need to spend more on healthcare. We just need to spend it differently. But, you know, the things that the Scandinavian welfare states do, they spend almost around 20% of GDP on what is called social protection, those kinds of traditional welfare state activities. That's about three times what we spend. Most of what we spend is on Social Security, and which should be, you know, expanded and be more generous, but it doesn't leave very much for the rest of the population. So you know, those sorts of things are very important. But I also, you know, want to see the workplace change. People, workers should have more say in how their work lives are run. It's like you enter your workplace and you enter an authoritarian relationship. You know, so we supposedly live in a democracy, although it's getting harder to believe that with each passing day. But you just have to surrender all your free will, your autonomy, your independence, and enter this authoritarian relationship with the boss. Just do whatever the boss says, and that's a problem.
Yeah, or he'll deprive you of your job, and you know, you can be out on the street.
Yeah, and you know, the cost of job loss, as they say, economists say in the U.S., is very, very high. Most people, you know, you have to go very far up the income distribution. Around to the 80th percentile or so before people actually have enough in the way of savings to live more than a few weeks without a paycheck. Most people are just a few paychecks away from severe poverty and then eventual homelessness. You know, that's a tremendous power the boss has over you. Like if you just, and I have a friend who has a union construction job in New York, and these guys are, you know, really secure, very well paid. And actually, I'm so used to FCC regulations. Can I use bad language on the program?
No problem.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. I have to watch myself when I'm doing, you know, FCC. Don't want to cross the FCC. But you know, this guy says he's one of these colleague of a friend of mine. The boss calls him up and says, "Come into work today." And this guy says, "No, I don't want to." He says, "Yo, you got to come in." He said, "No, go fuck yourself." And he said, "No, really? You got to come in." He said, "No, go fuck yourself." And he hung up on him. I'm like, holy shit! You know that the idea that you could tell a boss to go fuck yourself is just a thing of beauty to me. And you just can't. There aren't very many people who have that kind of job security. I mean, these guys are really, really skilled at what they do, and the union is quite strong. On top of that, so you know, they have that degree of freedom that almost no one else has.
I was just reading about a man who got fired from his job for he posted a meme on his Facebook of I think it was like an Elmo meme where Elmo was saying you know, I don't get paid enough, so I take a crap on the company dime, and he got fired. He got texted by his boss, who somehow found out about it through someone else that was on his Facebook, and he got canned. I mean, it is very authoritarian.
Well, in 49 of the states, a doctrine called at-will employment prevails. I think the exception is Wyoming. Maybe I can't remember what the exception is. Somewhere in the Mountain West, I think. But in 49 of the 50 states, you can be fired for any reason at all. The boss doesn't even have to, like, just doesn't like your shirt and fire you. Like, it's just, there's absolutely no security at all. And most other countries, rich countries in the world, have nothing like that. You know, the ability for a boss to fire people in the U.S. is just virtually unlimited.
Well, before we close out, I just wanted to get your thoughts on a few of the sort of current events in the zeitgeist right now. First and foremost, I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of this billionaire freakout over the possibility of a higher wealth tax.
Yes, it's very funny to watch this stuff going. You know, if you look back at our tax system from the New Deal through the ascension of Ronald Reagan, the average top tax rate was 80% or higher for most of that period. There just simply weren't fortunes of the size that we have now. Even if you adjust for inflation and economic growth and all that, the growth in these huge fortunes is just without precedent since the 1929 stock market crash, really. These guys over the last 30, 35 years have gotten so used to being very lightly taxed, if taxed at all, very lightly regulated, if regulated at all, and admired by a lot of the public, you know, and stroked by public policy. It's just been a grotesque encouragement of the accumulation of extreme wealth. So any slight change in that seems to them like the Bolshevik Revolution all over again. And I will say that between Sanders and Warren, there are some differences. The details of their tax policy are not wealth tax policies somewhat different. But I think there's an underlying political difference between the two of them. I suspect that Sanders would like to see billionaires just taxed out of existence. Warren's idea will be to tax them at some reasonably light level and just continue to use rich people as an ATM to fund public spending. I think if you tax these guys high enough, these pools of wealth will just eventually disappear over time. It would be like going back to that pre-1981 era where there just didn't exist these kinds of multi-billion fortunes. When Forbes first started doing its 400 list of the richest people in the country, and then they expanded it to a worldwide one too. The biggest fortunes were just a couple of $100 million. You know, now we've got to get on the Forbes 400, you have to have, you know, at least I can't remember what the cutoff is, but it's over $1 billion now. This explosion of these kinds of fortunes is unprecedented in modern history. And I suspect that billionaires see, first of all, these tax proposals. It's really hard to imagine that's ever getting through Congress without some kind of really dramatic change in our politics. But still, you know, were that to happen, you know, they would see themselves become less rich, and that would be a shock to them. But I think they're also responding to a change in the political atmosphere. We've gone from admiring wealth and looking at rich people with this almost voyeuristic pornographic sensibility to a real political hostility against these folks. Most people are seeing barely any income growth at all, disappearing benefits, speed up stress. We are 10 years into an economic expansion, and it still feels pretty crappy for a lot of people. and they see these guys just rolling in it, you know, there's an awful lot of resentment. And especially among young people who came of age during this crisis of capitalism back in 2008 and this ridiculous excuse for recovery expansion we've had since then. And there's an awful lot of class bitterness, and they get it. They feel it, and I think it scares them. It's not something they've had to, like, this modern crop of billionaires has never had to experience that. You have to go back decades and decades before you would come across this kind of overt class hostility.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I think if you instituted more social democracy, it would sort of lighten these sort of tensions a lot without, you know, going as radical as say, full socialism. That's why I'm always surprised that, you know, our elite class doesn't even want to give that little bit.
Well, I think they think give an inch, they'll take a yard, and that's what they're afraid of. And they're probably right. Like I said before, one of the core strategies of the neoliberal era has been beating down people's expectations. And if you let those rise, then, you know, they just want more.
Well, I'm going to let you go, but I just wanted to get your thoughts real quick on the sort of Democratic field right now. We have Michael Bloomberg, I guess, announcing. Yes. It seems like the Democrats are in a state of disarray yet again. A lot of times I think it's repeating 2016 all over again, and I have to compliment you. It seems like you called, you know, Hillary not being a great candidate way before anyone else.
Yeah, I got a lot of shit for that. And, you know, I had a critique of her, but I also said, whatever you think of her, she's a terrible candidate. You may regret this. And they didn't want to hear me. And I got to say, you know, it's kind of hard to evaluate what Trump has meant, because I don't know. I don't think that DSA would have 60,000 or 55,000 members now if Hillary had won. So I don't know. Maybe by breaking things up, Trump is good for the long term, but he's just been an absolutely awful, awful president. So many horrors he's perpetrated that the people who supported Hillary have a lot to answer for. And, you know, a lot of these Democrats who hoped for Trump to get the nomination, like Jonathan Chait and people like that. Hillary's people herself thought that he'd be a weaker opponent. And, they turned out to be very wrong. But yeah, it's funny to watch these centrists, the Dem centrists, really desperately trying to hold on, because they can see that all the energy, maybe not all the numbers, but all the energy is on the left end of the spectrum. The Sanders people and the Warren campaign. I prefer Sanders, but, you know, I have a lot of respect for Elizabeth Warren. She's more of a capitalist than I would like, but, certainly this, I think, would be a better country if she were president. And they see that's where the real energy is. This Bush advisor, Matthew Dowd, once said that if you argue against us while using our language, we're winning. I see a lot of that going around. Like, it's really the language, the debate, it's all the tone, the issues are all being set by, you know, the Sanders wing. The activist wing, the AOC, and like the Green New Deal. It's Green New Deal came out of nowhere, and within, you know, days, it seemed like people either had to be for or against it. So you know, you can see who's setting the terms of debate. The centrists get this on some level, and they just don't know what to do. I mean, Biden is a ridiculous candidate, worse than Hillary. You know, as much as I disliked Hillary, I could certainly respect her as a serious opponent, but Biden is just a fool and a joke. And now they're desperately pushing Mayor Pete, who as the New York Times said recently, I think he's running a strong fourth when he's like, you know, at 7% in the poll averages. They're just desperate for anybody who can offer some kind of attractive alternative to the left wing of the party, and they're having a very hard time of it. Bloomberg, he was, as a mayor in New York City, what you could say about him was he favored the rich, you know, Wall Street and real estate interests at the expense of everyone else. He is a good manager. You know, city government in like a day-to-day, the day-to-day sense works somewhat better than it had in the past. But his politics are, you know, decidedly very pro-rich. He turned the city, you know, more and more gentrified, more and more polarized. the idea that this guy could somehow be the attractive alternative to the class warriors is just fanciful. I mean, he is an embodiment of everything that's wrong with our politics. That, you know, when he was mayor, he was the richest guy in town. To have the richest guy in town be your mayor is almost like the definition of a plutocracy.
The strangest thing I've seen come out in the past few days was I don't know if it was a poll or it was some type of study on Sanders support, and it said that non-voters they don't like the left, but they like Sanders, and it was just a very bizarre thing to me to read. It seems like a lot of people now are driven ultimately by just this feeling of being completely annoyed with the establishment. It's not even necessarily about left and right for a lot of people anymore.
Well, yeah, like I said before, during the campaign or during the 2016 campaign, Sanders is the only one who can compete with Trump in the fuck you space. Like, that's what people respond to. And Trump, you know, can hardly open his mouth without lying about something. And Sanders is the very opposite of that. You know, this guy has just been very consistent, very principled, just very straightforward. But people like the fact that both these guys are just straight shooters. You know, Trump will say things that are the kinds of things you're not supposed to say aloud. And that's part of the scandal of Trump. He says things out loud that, you know, are supposed to be part of the hidden understanding of underside of American politics, but not be brought out in the open. And then Sanders, you know, in many ways has a certain similarity there, although, you know, I find his politics a whole lot more congenial than Trump's. But yeah, that kind of attitude of covering your message in bullshit is what appealed. Is why people can say they like both Trump and Sanders and no one else. Because Hillary was just pure focus group nonsense. She couldn't like say anything that wasn't full of qualifiers her message was always about diluting something. You know, it's like, so back during the days when the flag burning amendment, the Constitution was a hot issue. She said, "Oh, a flag burning amendment, that's too far. Let's just have a bill. A law against flag burning." That's the nature of Hillary. Let's split the difference. And people are just exhausted with that sort of thing. That the way the politicians lie and euphemize and so there's the sense of, you know, this I don't give a fuck sensibility that Trump has, or this rudeness, the class warrior rudeness of Sanders really is what cuts through that. All the, you know, the profound dishonesty we're, you know, marinating in.
Well, Doug Henwood, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views and providing some very keen insights. If you'd like to, maybe you could tell my listeners how they can follow your work or any upcoming projects you're currently working on.
Well, you could follow me on Twitter at Doug Henwood or have a blog, which I only write occasionally, but also has all entries for all my radio shows. So that's at lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com. So those are the two best ways to keep up with what I'm doing.
And thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Doug Henwood, founder of the Left Business Observer and host of the Behind the News radio program, which, by the way, you can find as part of Jacobin Radio, alongside such shows as The Dig and The Vast Majority. So do check that out, folks. Want to drop me a line about this episode of Parallax Views? Feel free to hit me up on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Also, please consider supporting me on Patreon if you enjoy the work I'm doing
with Parallax Views. Just released a raw video version of my conversation with Shane Bugby, and should be recording a new episode of Parallax Views The Week That Was, current events program, after technical difficulties with the last recording. So there's a lot to look forward to for Parallax Views Patreon supporters. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing this like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.